Welcome to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast, a weekly conversation about mental health, personal development, and all the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. For more information or to find a therapist in your area, visit our website at therapyforblackgirls.com. While I hope you love listening to and learning from the podcast, it is not meant to be a substitute for a relationship with a licensed mental health professional. Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for session 356 of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. We'll get right into our conversation after a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Dr. Uche Blackstock, and I'm on the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. I'm in session today, unpacking the historical relationship between Black people and hospitals.
I've seen quite a few videos on social media recently of young women soliciting help in finding the perfect dress for graduation. Might I suggest you add Macy's to your list? They have lots of options for dresses that will transition perfectly from under your gown to that incredible dinner with family after the ceremony. Check out options from brands like On 34th, Michael Kors, DKNY, and many more. Shop at Macy's.com or in store. Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and Brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Buying your first car can make you feel like a superstar as it's a big purchase, but it can take time to get there. Intuit is the financial platform that helps everyday people prosper. Whether you're trying to manage your money or trying to run a business, Intuit gives you the confidence to take control of your finances so you can live your best life. Intuit helps you take control of your finances through products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. Intuit has helped 100 million people live their best financial lives. Visit Intuit.com, I-N-T-U-I-T.com, to start living yours. Let's get into it. It's no secret that the relationship between Black people and the healthcare system is a fraught one. And as medical racism continues to go unaddressed, we're seeing more and more negative health outcomes for Black patients, including the perpetuation of harmful conspiracy theories and hesitance to seek medical help when in need. Joining me today to talk about the history and statistics behind some of these outcomes is health advocate and New York Times bestselling author, Dr. Uche Blackstock. Dr. Blackstock is the founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity, an organization created with the mission of partnering with healthcare organizations to dismantle racism in healthcare and to close the gap in racial health inequities. During our conversation, we discussed some of the most prevalent examples of hospital neglect experienced by Black patients, how healthcare systems can better engage with Black communities in order to engender trust, and how Black medical students can find support while studying to become physicians. If something resonates with you while enjoying our conversation, please share it with us on social media using the hashtag TBGInSession. Or join us over in the Sister Circle to talk more about the episode. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. Here's our conversation. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Blackstock.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to see you again.
You too. It's been a little while.
Indeed.
Since
indeed.
Essence Fest.
Right. We're rolling up on Essence time again this year, yes. Right? Yeah. So you are a highly accomplished author, New York Times bestselling author, a physician, and a health equity advocate. But I want you to take us back to your time at Harvard as a medical student. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like in a field that is predominantly not made up of us?
It's interesting because I should also reflect on how I grew up. I grew up thinking that most physicians were Black because my mother was a physician. My pediatrician was a Black woman. All of the physicians I was surrounded by growing up were Black, and a lot of them were Black women. So it really wasn't until I got older into medical school that I realized how few of us there were. And that environment, I would say, it was striking in a way for me because our numbers were so small. But within my class, there were a decent number of Black students. But when I think back on my experience during medical school, there was so much that we didn't learn about, right? Like, we never talked about racial health inequities. There is this Western biomedical model of how medicine is taught, that it's all about the physician and the patient, without really recognizing all of the systemic factors that impact health. And that was something that I did not learn in medical school, that I had to learn during my residency in emergency medicine, when I was working at a public hospital in Brooklyn, and afterwards as a practicing physician. So there was so much that I didn't learn. There were so many things that were implicitly taught about differences between Black patients and other patients, like that there were differences in kidney function, right? Between there were normal values for Black patients and normal values for non-Black patients, but we were never really told why.
Got it. And I would imagine that as you continued in your career, I know you started out in academic medicine, right? And so was a part of you wanting to go into practicing medicine in that way spurred by learning all these things that you wanted to then make right for students?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it was having a mother who was a physician, seeing all the work she was doing in our community with other Black physicians. And seeing her, I write about this in my book, about seeing her, how she interacted with her patients, really understanding the full context, social, political, in which they were living, and understanding that when her patients saw her, it wasn't just about what was happening in that room, in that exam room, that it was really more about what was happening in their lives, in their communities, at work, that all of that impacts health. So when I went to medical school and after medical school, I always knew that I wanted to work in service to our community. And that's when I became really aware of the racial health inequities that we have in our community as it relates to Black maternal mortality, life expectancy, how we're more often to carry the burden of chronic disease. And what I recognized also was that this was very little about the individual choices that we were making as Black people, and more so had to do with the fact that there are systems and practices and policies in place related to racism that impact our health, and getting really clear about that.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit more about Legacy. So Legacy is your book, Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. So you shared a little bit about the fact that you wrote about your mom and her journey as a physician. But what else might we be able to expect as a part of Legacy?
Well, Legacy, it has a double meaning, right? So as you allude to, about being a second generation Black woman physician, which is something that unfortunately today in 2024 is still so rare. Like the fact that my twin sister Oni and I and our mom were the first Black mother-daughter legacy graduates from Harvard Medical School. And that was 2005 when Oni and I graduated. Since then, there's only been one other Black mother-daughter legacy graduate. So that speaks to the work that these institutions have to do. Like, that is not acceptable, right? Also, just celebrating the journey and the work that my mother did in her short life. She died at 47 from acute myelogenous leukemia. And there was so much more that she could have done because she was doing health equity work at a time when we weren't even using that expression, right? She was doing work on behalf of the community, organizing community health fairs and working with her colleagues to make things better for residents and neighbors. But the other legacy piece is this history of medical racism, that the reason why in 2024 that we're seeing these health inequities, especially in Black communities, and the reason why they actually are worsening is because of a deeply rooted history of racism, not only in medicine, but in all other aspects of society that negatively impact Black health. So I wanted to be able to use this book to help connect the dots for a broad audience, not just people even in medicine, not just people in healthcare, but for the general public to understand the history, to understand the current day, and to understand why we're seeing these appalling statistics, and then ending the book with a call to action for different groups about how you can make a difference.
Yeah, so I want to spend some time today, Dr. Blackstock, talking more about hospital neglect. And I wondered if you could talk with us about some of the most prevalent examples of hospital neglect you have seen for Black patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many different ways. I think one of the main areas is how when Black patients go to seek care, often our concerns are dismissed, minimized, and ignored. Happens more often for Black women. And we're seeing that contributes to some of the poor outcomes, especially for Black birthing people, that when they are presenting with saying, I'm having bleeding, or I'm not feeling like myself, or I'm having swelling in my legs, health professionals are not listening to them. Another area is around pain and how pain is treated and not treated, how it's undertreated specifically. But we know, and we have studies that show that even in 2016, there was a study of medical students and residents that showed that some of them believed in these false myths about differences between Black patients and other patients, that we had thicker skin, we're less sensitive to pain. And because of that, this study actually showed that it was a mock case between a Black patient and a white patient, but showed that those students and residents were less likely to treat the Black patient's pain than the white patient's pain, even though everything was similar except the race of the patients. What we have in our healthcare system are health professionals who they think that they are providing equitable care. They think that they're doing their best. But the fact is that they are just like every other American. They're absorbing all this cultural messaging that's anti-Black, anti-Black women, that actually impacts how they make decisions about care.
So I wonder, Dr. Blackstock, if you can talk a little bit about what is the treatment for this, right? Can you talk a little bit about medical school curriculum and like what kinds of things? Is the field aware of this outside right. of you and the other physicians who are preaching on the hill about this? Is the field aware of this and what kinds of things are being done to combat some of these misconceptions?
I mean, yes, they are very much aware of this. Are they doing the work that needs to be done, the deep work? That's one of the reasons why I wrote Legacy, because I don't think they are doing enough. Some of these issues are just so deeply rooted in our medical education system. Like there's just been a gap in what we've been learning. But I also want to say that a lot of this has to start even before medical school, because we can't have pre-med students coming into medical school already holding these biases in their heads, right? So that's why it's so important, even starting as early as possible in our educational system, that we are making future health professionals aware of what the history is, aware of what the current day situation is for Black patients that are interfacing with the healthcare system. So yes, medical schools need to do their part. And what the part is making sure they're teaching about one, medical racism, the history of it, but also teaching about what are the experiences of Black patients today in 2024 when they seek healthcare, right? And what is the responsibility and obligation of health professionals when they're caring for Black patients? And that one, it's so simple as to say, like, truly listen to them, truly listen to us and understand that we are also human. We also feel pain. We also suffer, right? But also understanding the context in which we live in this country, that there's so many things that actually the outside of healthcare in terms of education, housing, employment, that also impact our health. So I think that medical schools have an obligation to educate future physicians to understand the experiences of their Black patients and to respond to those experiences and to care for us in a holistic way. And so medical schools have a lot of work to do because they're not doing the work. And a lot of it is because of the current political environment that we're in. We know that there's that act that was brought forth recently, a federal bill called the Educate Act, that is to defund medical schools that have diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. And how could that be that in 2024, when we're seeing the actually worsening of racial health inequities, that these sort of legislative bills are being brought forward?
Yeah. I mean, it really all is just like a microcosm for everything we are seeing in every other area of our lives, because you've already alluded to, and you wrote about in the book, that less than 2% of physicians are actually Black women, right? And right. So when you already talked about these institutions needing to do a better job of bringing in people, but also when the students are there, we've had conversations on the podcast about the treatment that sometimes happens when Black women are in medical school, and even the treatment of faculty, like how many faculty are pushed out or leave for their own sanity right. or health, right? So it feels really difficult to figure out like how you break into and make some differences in this kind of system when it does feel like the system is largely just miserable and built to work against us.
No, absolutely. You know, and I write in the book about my students that I work with and that I mentored who had their own experiences where they were just in medical school to learn how to be a doctor, but instead they had to focus on these DEI efforts because the school wasn't doing enough. And so when they should have been focusing on their work, they had to do all the heavy lifting, right? And then they have to deal with microaggressions. And they have to deal with, as we know, the data shows how Black students are evaluated differently than other students. The words used to describe us in our evaluations are different. Right. So it's like you said, like even once we get into these environments, right, getting into medical schools was just part of it. Then once you're in medical school, we're often in environments that are not supportive and hospitable to us. So it's again, at every step of the way, there are these barriers and challenges. Right. And even as a faculty, I write about how I was in academic medicine for 10 years. I thought that was going to be my future. Got appointed to a DEI role in our Office of Diversity Affairs and really got to see what the institution was about. And they were not about supporting me. So I had to make a very difficult decision. I call it a life-saving decision, actually, because when I look back, I was very unhappy. But also, I say I had forgotten I was someone that had gifts to share. Because often when we, Black women, are in these predominantly white environments, they undervalue us and underappreciate us so much that we lose sight of what we have to offer. So leaving that environment for me, even though I say I was very, very scared, because people don't leave academic medicine. It's very secure. I mean, I had multiple roles, multiple titles. People would have looked at me and thought I was happy, but I was actually miserable. And so, like I say, I made that life-saving decision because I was not thriving in that environment. When I look back at pictures that I took during that time, I'd lost a lot of weight. I wasn't sleeping. I had circles under my eyes. You know how you can look back at old pictures and be like, oh, that was not a good time? Yeah. So a lot of times as Black women, like we're forced into these situations where we have to make these tough decisions. We're like, do we stay? Do we leave? I left financial security, but I also left an environment that was psychologically violent to me.
Yeah. More from our conversation after the break. But first, a quick snippet of what's coming up next week on TVG.
When you should on yourself, you literally put the shoulds on you and you are judging. So a should signals judgment. The minute you use it in your vocabulary, I should mother this way. I should get married at 26 because that's what women do. I should have a baby. I should pursue this career path because this is what I went to school for. And it doesn't matter if I really like art. I should be a lawyer because that's what I got my degree in.
Attention all last minute shoppers. Just a reminder that Mother's Day is May 12th. And if you're like me, you're still trying to figure out the perfect gift for the amazing moms in your life. But no worries, Macy's has got you covered. They've got gift guides to make shopping a breeze. Whether you're looking for the perfect pieces for your fashionista mom or for your best friend who's celebrating her very first Mother's Day this year, you can shop by price, by category, and they even have specialty lists to help focus you even more, like a list for the mom who has it all, and a list of items that are already wrapped and ready to be gifted. Right now, some of this year's hottest items include digital picture frames and Polaroid cameras. With the help of their gift guides, I'm sure you'll find just the right thing. Head on over to Macy's.com/giftfinder for the perfect inspiration for Mother's Day. You may be aware that most people who are Black have O-type blood. O is commonly needed for emergencies and life-saving measures. But did you know 1 in 3 of us is a match for patients with sickle cell disease? You, along with the American Red Cross, regardless of your blood type, can help by donating blood. Every day, our blood saves lives and eases the pain for those living with sickle cell. When you donate blood, there is a direct, positive impact within our community. Right now, there is great need for blood donations in the African American community. Every donation counts and makes a difference in someone's life. Donate blood at Red Cross to help save a life. Black excellence is in our blood. Visit redcrossblood.org/ourblood to make an appointment now. Growing up watching media legends like Gwen Ifill and Robin Roberts always gave me the security that stories that matter to me would be told. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what kinds of things helped you to make that kind of decision, because I would imagine many of the people who are listening to our conversation now may find themselves in a similar situation, right? And not sure, like, how do I take this leap? Or I know this isn't healthy for me, but I'm not sure what to do. Can you share a little bit about your process?
I mean, I always say I consulted with my village. I have a wonderful therapist that I've been working with for the last 5 years. And she has seen me through some very, very difficult times. But just working with her, I feel like gave me permission to deviate off of that path that I thought I had to take. Especially in medicine, many of us are like, okay, we're like checking off boxes. I talk about, right? Pre-med, check. Medical school, check. Residency, check. Faculty position or job, check, right? And I realized I was just like going through the motions and not really thinking at each step, is this really what you want to do, Uche? So working with my therapist, Shaniqua, she doesn't mind me saying her name, but working with her really helped me through those very tough, tough moments. When I look back, I'm like, I don't even know how I got through it. But I know it was because of our biweekly sessions where I was given permission to think bigger. I was reminded that I was someone that had gifts to share. And it's interesting, when my book came out a few months ago, she sent me flowers and with a note, and she said, I have always seen the magic in you. And so you just need those kind of people in your lives. Of course, I have my twin sister, Oni, who was there every day supporting me. I would call her crying. And then my girlfriends, I talked to them. Many of them, maybe they were not in the same position as I was, but they saw how upsetting it was for me and encouraged me and said, you don't need to have an institutional affiliation. You don't need all the things that you think you're supposed to have to feel important. Like, you are enough on your own. And that was definitely a process that I had to internalize, that knowing that I did not need to be affiliated with NYU. I didn't need to be associate professor to know that I still can make an impact. And actually what I recognized was, listen, once I left that environment that was so incredibly stifling to me, it was just abundance flowed. Opportunities that I never thought would open up for me opened up. Doors opened. So if you had told me 5 years ago I would be where I am today, I would have been like, really? No, I don't think so. But truly.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate hearing about that because I think, again, many people, when we're checking off these boxes, we're just following what we think we're supposed to do and don't ever really check in with ourselves right. about whether this is something that feels right for me. You've already shared so much about like all of the racism and all of the other isms that impact the care that Black people get as a part of the medical institution. And I think an unfortunate byproduct of that is that there is often a lot of conspiracy theory, a lot of misinformation and disinformation that continues to be perpetuated in the Black community related to medicine. I mean, we saw that, of course, most recently related to the vaccine and just warranted concern about like whether this is something that is going to be good for us. So can you talk a little bit about like how that kind of system continues to perpetuate given what we know about the medical institutions?
Yeah, it's interesting because that misinformation or disinformation, I get it in a way because I talk about how healthcare institutions, all different societal institutions, have proven themselves untrustworthy to Black people for a very long time, right? So like, I think about how can you expect us when there is a pandemic out of the blue to then be like, okay, I'm going to get vaccinated when we have this, not only the history, but the current day mistreatment of Black people in healthcare settings. And so that's why I think it's so important, one, that we have Black health professionals who are out there speaking up using our platforms. And that's why, for me, it was so important. I never thought I would do like health communications or media work, but I saw that when the pandemic started, given all the misinformation that was out there, even from the presidential administration, I was like, okay, we got to get out there, Black folks who are in health, we got to get out there to make sure that our communities have the information they need to make an informed decision. Like no one's trying to like force anything on anyone. I just want to make sure that we have the information to make an informed decision. And I think that is critical. The other thing I think is it's a reminder of when healthcare institutions don't center or have not centered Black communities, that you don't engender trust, right? I talk about in the book how even my barber, I used to wear my hair really short in my 20s. My barber and I still see him all the time in my neighborhood. We stop and talk. But he reached out to me about a year after the vaccine came out and said, I really want to talk to you because I don't have insurance. I don't have a primary care doctor. You're the only doctor I know and you're the only doctor I trust. A year after, and we talked like for an hour on the phone with his adult daughter, who also had not been vaccinated yet, he asked me the most thoughtful questions. And one thing he said to me is like, I know that there are other folks like Dr. Anthony Fauci on television saying I should take this vaccine, but I don't trust him. I don't know who he is. He's like, and I trust you. So that's why I think it is so, so, so important that the investments in our community happen in terms of creating a strong relationship between the healthcare system and our community. It should be ongoing because we saw what happens when it's not ongoing. And that kind of environment allows that misinformation and disinformation to spread, where people tell me, oh, my hairdresser or my barber told me that the vaccine doesn't work, or just like inaccurate information. People were listening to people who were not even in healthcare.
Yeah. Getting information from all kinds of places.
I know. Or like, you know, social media or some WhatsApp thread. And that is dangerous. It's dangerous.
We also know that there's also a large focus, I think, again, rightfully so, on like more natural kinds of ways to take care of ourselves. Can you speak to how we can kind of vet information about what people aren't necessarily wanting to sign up for, like more traditional kinds of medicine? What kinds of things can we do to kind of vet sources and to really integrate maybe more natural ways of healing into our practices?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's such an important question because, again, my training is from the Western biomedical model, traditional, right? And we know that there are other ways that people can care for themselves in a more holistic way. But yes, making sure the source of the information is important. So I always say just to make sure that people are vetting the source, looking at the background of this person, what kind of experience, what kind of training do they have? Do other people who are responsible, trusted messengers, do they follow these people? Are they people who others can co-sign on that what they're saying is accurate information? And so it doesn't matter how many followers someone has, but maybe reading up on them, reading up on their background, I think could be helpful.
Can you share some of your favorite like websites or podcasts or other kinds of things where you send people for like trusted information?
Oh, that's interesting. I feel like I send them to my to myself. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But no, I feel like there are a lot of like Black health influencers in different specialties that I can co-sign because I know them personally, like Dr. Heather Urubunda, who is an obstetrics gynecologist, or Dr. Camila Phillips, who I've known since I was very, very young person. I also think that we have to remember that groups like the National Medical Association, the largest and oldest organization of Black physicians, they have a lot of great resources on their website. Health in Her Hue also, which is a startup that was founded by Dr. Ashley Wisdom, has a directory of health professionals that are trained to care for Black women and women of color, but they also have a lot of educational content on their website that people can use that has been vetted thoroughly. And then for people who are interested in maternal health issues, there's an app called the Earth app, IRTH, started by a Black woman also that has a lot of information, really accurate information about the birthing process, and also has a provider directory too.
Thank you so much for sharing that. More from our conversation after the break. Attention all last minute shoppers. Just a reminder that Mother's Day is May 12th. And if you're like me, you're still trying to figure out the perfect gift for the amazing moms in your life. But no worries, Macy's has got you covered. They've got gift guides to make shopping a breeze. Whether you're looking for the perfect pieces for your fashionista mom or for your best friend who's celebrating her very first Mother's Day this year, you can shop by price, by category, and they even have specialty lists to help focus you even more, like a list for the mom who has it all and a list of items that are already wrapped and ready to be gifted. Right now, some of this year's hottest items include digital picture frames and Polaroid cameras. With the help of their gift guides, I'm sure you'll find just the right thing. Head on over to Macy's.com/giftfinder for the perfect inspiration for Mother's Day. You may be aware that most people who are Black have O type blood. O is commonly needed for emergencies and life-saving measures. But did you know 1 in 3 of us is a match for patients with sickle cell disease? You, along with the American Red Cross, regardless of your blood type, can help by donating blood. Every day, our blood saves lives and eases the pain for those living with sickle cell. When you donate blood, there is a direct, positive impact within our community. Right now, there is great need for blood donations in the African American community. Every donation counts and makes a difference in someone's life. Donate blood at Red Cross to help save a life. Black excellence is in our blood. Visit redcrossblood.org/ourblood to make an appointment now. Many people feel anxious when they think about finances. It can feel overwhelming, stressful, and even hopeless, especially when you're first starting out and don't know what to do. But when you have a solid financial plan in place, this anxiety turns into confidence. You can regain a sense of control over your life and improve your self-esteem. How do you build financial confidence? Intuit is the financial platform that helps everyday people prosper. Whether you're trying to manage your money or trying to run a business, Intuit gives you the confidence to take control of your finances so you can live your best life. Intuit helps you take control of your finances through products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. Intuit has helped 100 million people live their best financial lives. Visit Intuit.com, Intuit.com, to start living yours. Let's get into it. Dr. Blackstock, I wonder if you could say more about how our mistrust and distrust of medical institutions and hospitals really impacts health outcomes for Black people.
Yeah, so that's like the other impact, right? So when we have a very high burden of unmet needs in our communities, because when people don't trust the healthcare system and they're not feeling well, they end up not pursuing care or not seeking care. So what happens is they're having symptoms, whether it's lightheadedness, chest pain, whatever it may be, it ends up progressing. So by the time they do seek treatment, they are sicker than they would have been. They may have more advanced cancer. They may have uncontrolled high blood pressure or diabetes. that lead to more complications, harm, and even death. So that's why I think it's so important that the way that we frame this sort of mistrust and distrust for healthcare, that is actually ends up being very, very harmful for us. But again, it's up to the institutions to center our communities, center our voices, our priorities and needs, and to do that engendering the trust process. That is so, so important.
We talked about this a little bit, but I'd love to hear more of your thoughts. One of the, I think, most awful outcomes of everything that happened with the pandemic was a loss of trust for institutions that I think largely had been credible. And specifically, I'm thinking about the Centers for Disease Control, right? Like the CDC. I had always thought the CDC, like, okay, this is like the gold star of information. If anything happens, like they're going to have the right information. They're going to like steer us right. But I think in the pandemic, we largely saw, and I think political reasons were behind this, but that we could not even trust, I think, some of the information coming from the CDC. So what is the work that institutions like the CDC need to do to regain the public's trust so that we can have a public health field again?
Right. It's so interesting because the CDC, it is a predominantly white institution, and it has the same issues internally, right, in terms of representation of Black folks, in terms of prioritizing health equity as every other organization. So they are not immune to that. I think that the pandemic showed us that there is so much self-reflection and inner work that the CDC needs to do. And what does that look like? That looks like engaging with communities. That looks like hiring, retaining, promoting Black public health professionals. That looks like prioritizing what ideal health equity looks like. And there's so many opportunities for them to partner with Black-led organizations that are already embedded in the community, right? I think that is how they can engender trust, like investing resources, funding into organizations, because there's so many organizations out there that are already doing the work. How can we lift up their work? And I think the CDC needs to think about what kind of partnerships can they do with community-based organizations that are already doing the work, that already have relationships with community members, and not reinvent the wheel.
So in the meantime, while we are waiting for these systems to change, we know that means that there is a lot of work that needs to be on the individual, right?
I know.
In terms of advocating for themselves and doing all of these things. What suggestions would you have for people about how they can advocate for themselves within the medical system?
I know. And it's interesting because that question, I'm always like, it's the system, as you alluded to, it's the system. Like, it shouldn't be on us to feel like we're going to war when we are seeking care, when we are at our most vulnerable, at our weakest, in discomfort and pain, right? But a few things. So I don't know if you saw this recently. There was a viral, I think it on social media, of a white male physician who said, he's like, I want to know why when I go into the room to see Black patients, they usually have someone on FaceTime. Hello, it's because they don't trust you and they need someone else there like for surveillance. So I say, bring someone with you to your appointments, a loved one, a family member, your best friend, someone who can help support you, whether it be just to ensure that you are getting respectful, dignified care, or someone who can make sure that you're asking all the questions that you need to ask. I also think it's important for people to go into the healthcare settings prepared. So take notes on what your symptoms have been like, the duration of your symptoms, the quality of your symptoms, what has worked, what hasn't worked. Make sure to have notes, because a lot of times when we get in front of a health professional, we get nervous, anxious. Also, if we're not feeling well, we may not be able to share all the details. Making sure that you ask that health professional, what do you think is going on? What is your plan for me? What is my follow-up? What are red flags I should look out for where I would come back or go to the emergency department? Making sure that you have answers to those questions. And then I think that I always say, and this is more difficult, obviously, in emergency medicine settings, but if you feel like your health professional is not listening to you, minimizing your complaints, get a second opinion, get a third opinion, right? The other thing is, I think that we have our informal circles, our friends. I do it even as a physician. I ask my girls, my village, who do you see for this? Who's your dermatologist? Who's your OBGYN, right? Because these are people that we already know have been vetted and we know will give us good care. But like I mentioned, there are provider directories out there. National Medical Association has them. Health in Her Hue has one specifically for Black women and women of color. We are creating the solutions, right? To make sure that we are receiving respectful and equitable care.
And are there specific questions that we can ask providers that can help us to vet whether they are culturally competent or culturally responsive?
I think that is more challenging. But I think maybe when you go see someone, you can ask them, what is your patient population like? Even looking about, like, where did they train? Where did they go to medical school? What kind of settings have they been practicing in? A lot of that you can actually find out online. I would look at even physician reviews, even though sometimes people may go in there and it may not be accurate in terms of what folks are saying, but you're definitely looking up physician reviews and seeing what people are saying about them, because that can be very helpful as well.
Dr. Blackstock, I wonder what kind of message or charge would you give to either current medical students or future medical students about how they can continue to advance this work, even if it is not being taught as a part of their formal curriculum?
Yes. It's interesting because I actually gave a keynote talk the week before last to the Student National Medical Association, which is the largest organization for Black pre-medical and medical students. One, I wanted to remind them that it's a hard road to becoming a physician, especially in these predominantly white institutions, that they really have to be clear on what their purpose is, what their values are, always stay in alignment, but also gather your village around you. Find the people, other students that you can trust. Find the faculty that are open to mentoring and sponsoring you and to help support you if something comes up. I think organizing is something we don't talk about in medical school, but organizing, the more students that we have that are speaking up about these kind of issues, the more protected you are. Yeah, I mean, I don't try to sugarcoat it because I know there's so much more work that medical schools need to do in creating diverse, inclusive environments for our students where they can show up authentically. And I also say, just keep your village, keep your family close to you, your loved ones, your blood and chosen family close to you, because they're the ones that are going to keep you grounded during a process where you're in an environment that is very unfamiliar to you and sometimes unwelcoming to you. So stay grounded, remembering your purpose, seeking help when you need to, finding your village, whether it be other students or faculty. When I was faculty, I really felt like it was my purpose and obligation to support our students. Like, if something came up, to speak on behalf of them, to let their instructors know that something is going on, to really have their back. And I know there are a lot of Black faculty out there that are still doing that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that, Dr. Blackstock. I wonder if you could share how we can stay connected to all the work that you're doing and where can we grab a copy of your book?
Sure. So my organization is Advancing Health Equity. So that's actually what I left academic medicine to focus on. It's 5 years old this month. It's a health equity consulting firm, and we work with healthcare organizations around the issues we're talking about today to create diverse, inclusive environments where we can retain Black health professionals and where we can deliver the most equitable care to our patients. So the website for Advancing Health Equity is www.advancinghealthequity.com. But if you want to follow me on social media, because I talk about these issues all the time, they mean so much to me. I'm on Instagram at @UcheBlackstockMD. I'm on Twitter at @Uche_Blackstock, and I'm on LinkedIn as well. And I also have my own website, www.uchablackstock.com, if people are interested in book events and some media that I've appeared in. And Legacy, my New York Times bestseller, is available wherever books are sold. But I always recommend people to buy local, buy Black owned. So find those stores close to you.
We'll be sure to include all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Dr. Blackstock.
Thank you, Dr. Joy.
I'm so glad Dr. Blackstock was able to join us for this episode. To learn more about her and her work, be sure to visit the show notes at therapyforblackgirls.com/session356. And don't forget to text two of your girls right now and tell them to check out the episode. If you're looking for a therapist in your area, check out our therapist directory at therapyforblackgirls.com/directory. And if you want to continue digging into this topic or just be in community with other sisters, come on over and join us in the Sister Circle. It's our cozy corner of the internet designed just for Black women. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. This episode was produced by Elise Ellis and Zaria Taylor. Editing was done by Denison Bradford. Thank y'all so much for joining me again this week. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you all real soon. Take good care.
What?
Nowadays, a lot of these big companies pretend to care about our communities and issues with nothing more than lip service. State Farm is the opposite. They're actively investing in programs and initiatives that help educate in financial literacy, give early career advice, and grow Black-owned businesses, thus leading to generational wealth, which helps protect the future of our communities. Seeing our communities grow and thrive is something they care deeply about. They want to build a future that we all can be proud of. State Farm understands that representation alone doesn't mean authenticity, that it takes a good neighbor to sponsor programs like the AXO, a year-long program that recognizes and rewards high school students for their academic and cultural achievements, and to fund programs like Project Ready, a National Urban League program committed to the educational achievement of Black and brown youth that to date participants have been awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities and can have a long-lasting impact. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.